it. Even though I know the right hand shouldn't know what the left hand does, it would be useful for me to be informed of any support action. I did expressly indicate that this type of grant should not become a permanent habit. The sick Burley, Adolf, and Christmas are special occasions, and only such occasions can be appropriate for this. K.H. has written to me in a positive way, and I would like to thank him for his generosity in this matter. In another letter home, Mengele complained, "Despite this undoubted generosity, it upsets me to be a financial burden to him. Everything comes out of his private funds. One can't ignore that these amounts have, over time, become a considerable sum, and even they were not enough." However, Mengele's embarrassment did not stop him from begging Karl Heinz for more money after Gerhard told him that the cost of his son Burley's treatment had escalated because the child needed more surgery. In a letter to Sedlmeier, Mengele said, "After more than a year, my friend has finally written to me, and naturally, not much good news. About Burley, Adolf, he had to be operated on again for further medical care by the female cancer doctor, the doctor who the neurologists think is having some success, and for this medical care he did not have the means. He doesn't say anything about how he intends to get those means, and leaves it to my intelligence to guess it. I guessed it, as of course you would have done. So we both know what he probably thinks or expects. What I mean is this, once you say, 'dumb man,' false identity card, then one must take the consequences, and the consequences in this case are the sick son. How much you want to know? Last time it was between 4,000 and 5,000 DMs, Deutschmarks, approximately $1,600. Most likely it has not gotten any cheaper. Therefore I want you to explain these facts to Karl Heinz, and ask him for his assistance in my name. When I wrote my letter to him, it seemed inappropriate to mention it. He will understand that. This matter does not permit any delay." Mengele's concern about his finances and his health provoked another major crisis. Although he had recovered movement in his limbs within the first 24 hours of hospital treatment, his stroke had left him in an acutely anxious state. Fawcett wrote to Sedlmeier that, "His relentlessness comes out in his physical disquiet. He can't sit still. He constantly taps his fingers and clips his fingernails." Mengele had become obsessed with his health. His letters home to Günzburg were marked with minutely detailed reports about his declining health and anxious state. "I suffer from an unusual phenomenon which doesn't improve. It consists of a very strong reaction to a surprise stimulation, e.g. the noise of a car backfiring, not noticing a person is there, unexpectedly being spoken to. This exaggerated shock reaction embarrasses me so far as others noticing it is concerned. They laugh and wonder what's going on. I can't explain my craziness to everybody who take me for an anxious fool. The trembling of my right hand during difficult work, e.g. handling a screwdriver, seems to have increased. Or do you think that these are general aspects of aging?" Deprived of the ability to pursue his favorite pastime of making handicrafts, Mengele was reduced to aimlessly puttering about the house. His relationship with his neighbors had not advanced beyond a superficial state. They saw only a smiling facade, polite and self-contained. "If you asked what country he was from, he would always say, 'Europe,'" said Jaime de Santos, a local caretaker. "I liked him. He was nice. He never got angry or nervous." When de Santos was short of money and asked him for a loan, Mengele readily complied. But beneath this neighborly veneer, his failing health and financial worries had created a deeply disturbed old man. In his diary, Mengele wrote, "My mood is as if burned out. All what one does seems so senseless. All is so empty." Mengele also wrote a letter to Sedlmeier in which he showed that he was again contemplating suicide. The fact that again and again I have to come to you asking this type of favor, money, embarrasses me, but it seems to be part of the game. Sometimes I think I should finally give up. It is so hopeless all alone. But then again, this type of despair doesn't seem right to me. Everything in life that has special value is costly. Sometimes one gets these sudden passing phases, but you must not allow yourself to go crazy. As Mengele's pleas for money to pay Gerhardt became more desperate, Sedlmeyer began to suspect that Gerhardt was inflating his son's medical expense claims for his own personal benefit. I cannot yet say how K.H. will respond to the requests of the tall man, Gerhardt. He was informed by a copy of one of your letters to me, and he must decide for himself. I'll keep my opinion about the tall man's behavior to myself, but I have to say that I fear that he uses Burley's, Adolf's, condition to improve his finances, because his medical expenses and necessary cures will be refunded for the most part. Since my last reported meeting with the tall man, I haven't been back to him. I will let you know the decision that K.H. reaches in this matter as soon as I get a chance to talk with him. On the other hand, Mengele reminded Sedlmeyer of just how valuable Gerhardt had been in helping him evade capture. "He has done me an unrepayable favor. A favorable conclusion to this business is important for me. He really offered me friendship and services that no amount can pay off." But Sedlmeyer's response did not give Mengele's spirits much of a boost. "I don't have a resolution from K.H. on the matter. I have reminded him, but he has left the matter in abeyance. How important you consider this is evident from your last and second-to-last letters, of which I have sent him copies. I count on talking to him about that during the next few days, and if not, I will remind him." It was during this crisis period that Mengele found strength and hope in only one thought: the possibility that, after a 21-year separation, he might at last see his only child, Rolf. Chapter 17. Now I Can Die in Peace. Mengele's instructions for his son's secret visit resembled a set of military orders. From the moment he first suggested the idea in 1973, Mengele insisted that Rolf travel on a false passport and lay a series of false trails. "There must be no flaw in the plan," he warned his son. "We must not make the smallest mistake." Rolf had taken 4 years to decide that he would make the long journey to Brazil, an odyssey, as his father later called it. Father and son, joined by blood, separated by history, had different reasons for wanting this extraordinary reunion. Rolf, torn by doubts about his father's monstrous past, torn by loyalty to his own flesh and blood, could not postpone the confrontation any longer. "I was fed up with the written arguments," he said. "I wanted to talk to my father, confront him personally." Mengele awaited the moment with great anticipation, moved more by curiosity than by real affection, prepared for the only inquisition in his life. "You wish to have a dialogue," he said. "Very well." Yet a real dialogue was almost certainly out of the question. It was clear to Rolf, from the self-righteous tone in one of his father's letters, that he would not tolerate close scrutiny of the dark secrets of his past. "On the one hand, I cannot hope for your understanding and compassion for my life's course. On the other, I do not have the minutest inner desire to justify or even excuse any decisions, actions, or behavior regarding my life. When it comes to indisputable traditional values, where I sense danger to those close to me or to the unity of my people, my tolerance has its limits." Nevertheless, Mengele, lonelier than he had ever been in his life, hoped the visit would be a lengthy one. "It is not going to be easy for me to express how much I look forward to that meeting. perhaps with the confession that it represents the next goal in my life. Therefore, I want you to reflect on not making the stay too short." Despite this earnest plea, Mengele could still not resist a taunting sting for Rolf. He would never let Rolf forget that he had ignored him for most of his life. In one breath, he thanked Rolf for sending greetings on his 66th birthday. In the next, Mengele jibed, "I am pretty sure you will care more about your mother's birthday than mine." In the same letter, Mengele could not resist another dig. Irena had been badly injured in a car accident. "Let's stay with your mother and her bad luck," he wrote. "When I learned of that event 2 months later from Uncle Ha, Sedlmeyer, besides my own deep inner feelings, I was disappointed that I was not informed by you." With nothing else to do except fret about his health and financial problems, Mengele occupied himself with planning the trip down to the last detail. In May 1977, he wrote to Sedlmeyer, imploring him to ensure that Rolf use a false passport, or dumb man, and gave detailed instructions for his arrival in Sao Paulo. "The final meeting place cannot yet be divulged. It should not be given directly, but rather by an intermediary, in order to detect possible shadowing. Having successfully passed through the airport controls, he should first go to the hotel, then by taxi to the Estação do Metro, subway station, Vila Mariana. From there, he will go by underground to the San Bento station, directly in the center. If he feels he is being shadowed during these travels, then the only solution is to go back to the hotel, to hang around town for a few days, and then to travel back home again." Mengele need hardly have worried, since the West Germans were not giving the slightest priority to following any members of his family. But since he did not know that, his elaborate instructions to Rolf continued with an echo from the past. "Use the subway in an inconspicuous manner," he urged his son, advising him how to merge with the crowd on the platform, just as he had done on his escape by train through Italy in 1949. He also told Rolf how to get to the Bossert's house. From there, Wolfram Bossert would lead him to the ramshackle bungalow on Alvarenga Road. "The reason for all this travelling, apart from security, is that there is no one in Moose, Bossert's house between 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. Should the arrival not be between these times, then for security reasons it is still advisable to take the underground trip. Only the traveller goes from San Bento back to Vila Mariana and takes a taxi there to Moose house. If I am given the exact time of arrival, including the hour, then I can prepare things much better." He also asked Rolf to bring presents for the Bossets, a few engravings of towns, little objets d'art, etc. It won't be very much. Mengele criticized his family for not paying more attention to those who had helped him. "Just a note of thanks and a token gift would suffice to keep them all happy," he complained to Sedlmeyer. "I don't understand. After the Gay and Guy, Stammers, disaster, that this still hasn't dawned on you. Your response to my request, that you should send a few kind words to the Moose, Bossets, is typical of your attitude to my friends." For himself, he asked Rolf to bring a Latin-English dictionary, parts for his German-made electric razor, some tape recordings, and copies of Ovid's Tristia, Elegies, and Epistulae ex Ponto, Letters from the Black Sea. He also asked Sedlmeyer to buy Rolf and Karl Heinz a book just written by his friend Hans-Ulrich Rudel, in which the Luftwaffe ace reaffirmed his faith in Hitler and featured pictures of his wartime aerial exploits. "One day it will be of historical value," Mengele forecast. The German Bundestag had just been in an uproar over the Luftwaffe's presentation of a special honor guard for Rudel when he visited an airbase to autograph copies. Mengele was outraged at the political storm. "I only read casual references to Uhle's affair," he fumed. "Naturally, the whole mob of characterless subservience which nowadays tyrannizes Germany tear into him." Mengele said the ultimate irony was that Israel could now teach Germany a lesson in national pride and military strength. Sedlmayr promised to do his best to get the presents, but a signed copy of Rudel's book was proving more difficult. "Most bookshops don't carry his books," Sedlmayr wrote back. "Getting his signature might be even more difficult. Since his stroke, he can hardly write with his left hand. If the young, Rolf and Karl Heinz, are interested in these, I'll leave it to them to buy." At Mengele's request, Sedlmayr was in charge of checking the security of Rolf's travel plans. On May 27, 1977, he wrote to Mengele, saying that Rolf intended to travel that September by charter flight from Luxembourg to Rio de Janeiro, that he had obtained a false passport, and that he would stay for 4 weeks, 3 of them at your disposal. Sedlmayr explained, "On Monday I met Rolf. We went through the plan in detail. He won't be able to hire a car for various reasons. Perhaps Mu could rent one for him, since he doesn't have a driver's license that fits his passport. He will have to show his normal license if he is checked, but this is something you must decide there. I don't need to go into detail about the plan. It's bound to be a lot easier than you imagine. We both laughed at your instructions. As soon as the flight is confirmed, I will let you know the exact date. Whether he is going to do the Rio-Sao Paulo stretch by internal flight or by train or bus, only he will decide at the time and place. He wants to move around like a tourist without any constraints and make his decisions as and when the mood takes him. Don't forget that he's much travelled, speaks fluent English, and is not afraid of hardship." Mengele was furious and alarmed that his instructions were not being obeyed to the letter. He wrote back to Sedlmayr and insisted that on no account should Rolf risk driving a car unless he had an international driver's license that matched his false passport. And he demanded to know more details about the passport itself. "The first irrevocable demand is the perfect assistant, false passport, about which I did not learn a thing in your last letter. Recent information I got concerning entry controls suggests there could be serious problems. If all my conditions are respected, then, as you say, everything will be much easier, and I won't have to imagine anything. I don't propose to signal my agreement until I know every detail about the assistant. I am also totally confused by your remark about a tourist wanting to move around freely. I'd always thought he was coming to see me." In the midst of these angry exchanges, Rolf delayed his trip a number of times. Sedlmayr began to lose patience with Rolf as well as his father. In August, he asked Rolf to make up his mind. "You should have discussed things in more detail. For the time being, I won't announce your new date, in order not to cause any confusion, especially since I can't really give an excuse for this new change." 2 days later, Sedlmayr was so exasperated that he wrote to Mengele asking to be relieved of his role as middleman in the travel plans. Mengele had accused him of inventing reasons for Rolf's continued delays. Sedlmayr had tired of Mengele's idiosyncrasies and paranoia. "Unfortunately, you misinterpreted my statements about the tourist business and of Rolf having no fixed dates for the journey. He should write to you himself about this, as I think it only right that all further details to do with the trip, the reporting, and all the correspondence should be left to Rolf." But Mengele and his son were not able to resolve the final details, and the ever-faithful Sedlmayr stepped in to mediate again. Finally, the travel date was fixed, October 10th. As a bonus, Sedlmayr held out the prospect of a special visit by Mengele's old friend, Hans Rudel, who was convalescing after treatment for a stroke at the Mayo Clinic in the United States. "1 week ago, I was visiting Uli, Rudel, and spent a couple of hours there. I would have asked him to visit you in case he has time. He said he would see when it was possible. After he visits the U.S., he will visit La Paz, Paraguay, and Brazil. to prepare Rolf for the meeting, and to fully brief him about the background of his father's circumstances in Brazil, Sedlmeier arranged a meeting with Karl Heinz, who through regular correspondence was on more intimate terms with Mengele than was his own son. It took place in August, in Sedlmeier's garden in Günzburg. The trio also went over an outline travel plan, and Karl Heinz gave Rolf $5,000 to take to Mengele. We spent many hours in my garden and had an opportunity to discuss the undertaking in all its details, Sedlmeier reported to Mengele. Finally, Sedlmeier had a word of warning for Mengele, locked as he was in a Nazi time warp. Rolf, he would find, represented a generation of German youth whose ideology and values were wholly different from his own. The world, especially here with us, has changed tremendously, and these changes have passed you by. You have not been through these times with us. You have no right to criticize from afar. The preconditions that you take as a basis for all actions and thoughts simply no longer exist. You have stood still in the concepts of the old days, which, unfortunately, yes, I use the word unfortunately, are no longer valid. Rolf departed for Rio de Janeiro from Frankfurt with a $600 charter ticket on Varig Airlines. He travelled on a passport which he had stolen from a friend, Wilfried Busser, when they were on holiday earlier that year. Busser had left his passport in the car when he stopped to buy something from a shop. "I looked down and saw Wilfried's picture," said Rolf. "I thought to myself, that looks just like me." My father had been going on and on about a foolproof passport, so I thought, that's the one. As his father had instructed, Rolf brought with him gifts for the Bossetts and for his father, a Latin-English dictionary, an attachment for his electric razor, and the $5,000 cash from Karl Heinz. An hour or so into the flight, Rolf began to have last-minute doubts. He said, "I remember thinking to myself, should I really be going? It won't change anything." But these misgivings were just nerves. I knew that I wouldn't turn back once I got to Brazil. It was something I had to do. I'd been thinking about it for too long. Rolf was accompanied by a second friend, whose name he will not disclose, the only person outside his family circle whom he completely trusted to keep the secret. This friend held Rolf's real passport in his pocket to be produced in case Rolf was challenged by Brazilian immigration. Their plan was simple. Once Rolf had safely entered Brazil, he would visit his father in Sao Paulo while his friend enjoyed the beaches in Rio. Rolf would return to Rio for the scheduled return charter flight to Germany, together with his friend. "I wasn't at all nervous about entering Brazil," said Rolf. "My friend and I had travelled together before when we worked in the Middle East and used to play games with each other's passports to see if we could get through immigration. On this occasion, the Brazilians didn't even give me a second look." Rolf spent his first night in Brazil in Rio de Janeiro's poshest hotel, the Otton Palace, checking in as Wilfried Busser. The next day, he boarded a commuter plane to Sao Paulo. Once there, in order to cover his trail and to ensure that he was not followed, he took three taxis in a circuitous route before arriving at the Bossetts' house at 7 Missouri Street. The final leg of the journey was accomplished in Bossetts' rickety old Volkswagen bus. As he pulled into Alvarenga, a dusty road full of potholes, Rolf Mengele experienced probably the strangest collection of emotions that any son has ever felt for his father. He was about to meet the most hated man in the world. The Volkswagen stopped in front of Mengele's house. "It was actually more of a hut," said Rolf. "I was tired and suffering from nervous exhaustion." It had been 21 years since Rolf last saw his father. In the Swiss Alps, when he knew him as a long-lost uncle, who had held him spellbound with tales of daring wartime exploits. During those 21 years, his father had been revealed as a monster. The man standing at the gate now was a shadow of the hero of old. The pride had gone, so had the self-assurance. There was a pathetically eager look about his father as he raised his arms for an awkward embrace. "The man who stood before me," said Rolf, "was a broken man, a scared creature." Josef Mengele was trembling with excitement. There were actually tears in his eyes. Rolf felt as if he were in the presence of a stranger. "That's when I made a few gestures to overcome the unfamiliarity and the emotion," he said, and he responded to his father's offer of an embrace. The bungalow his father was living in was small and simple. Mengele slept on the brick floor. Rolf had the bed. And then the questioning began, cautiously at first, with Rolf affecting a conciliatory approach, getting his father to state his case, lulling him into a false sense of security, so that Mengele might think that his son shared, after all, a sympathetic view. In fact, Rolf had adopted a lawyer's approach, calculating that only by patiently drawing his father out could he spot the weaknesses and flaws in his case, which would allow him to prepare for a robust and probing cross-examination. "I told my father I was interested in hearing about his time in Auschwitz. What was Auschwitz, according to his version of events? What did he do there? Did he have a role in the things he was charged with?" For tactical and psychological reasons, I very cautiously touched upon this subject, trying to analyze it and separate out the more obscure and complex arguments my father was trying to inject. Night after night, the inquisition went on. Mengele's answers were so full of philosophical and pseudo-scientific verbiage that Rolf began to fear my mind would be overrun. His father kept straying off the essential points, justifying his racist views, falling back at one stage on a detailed critique of prehistoric evolution. When Mengele had finally exhausted his hand, Rolf launched his counter-offensive. "Why," Rolf asked him, "if he felt so sure of his ground, had he not turned himself in?" "My father replied, 'There are no judges, only avengers,'" said Rolf. How could his father explain that many crippled and deformed people had brilliant minds? My father could not give me a proper answer to that. He just waffled on and on. What precisely was his evidence for asserting that some races were superior to others? Here, most of his arguments were sociological, historical, and political, said Rolf. They were quite unscientific. Wasn't such an attempt to categorize races in any case immoral and deeply inhuman? My father knew that this was my route into Auschwitz and what he did there, said Rolf. He saw my approach and knew that I hadn't accepted what he'd been saying. In the 14 days and nights that Rolf spent with his father, he learned a lot about his father's moods, his suicidal tendencies, his depression, his temper. He learned nothing about what his father did in the war. In a philosophical way, Mengele tried to justify what he had done without saying exactly what it was, but never once did he admit his guilt. I proposed that whatever he or anyone else did or did not do in Auschwitz, I deeply detested it, since I regard Auschwitz as one of the most horrible examples of inhumanity and brutality. He said I did not understand. He went there, had to do his duty to carry out orders. He said everybody had to do so in order to survive, the basic instinct of self-preservation. He said he wasn't able to think about it. From his point of view, he was not personally responsible for the incidents at the camp. He said he didn't invent Auschwitz. It already existed. He said that he had wanted to help people in the camp, but there had been a limit to what he could do. As far as selections were concerned, he said, the situation was analogous to a field hospital during time of war. If 10 wounded soldiers are brought into the hospital in critical condition, the doctor must make almost instantaneous decisions about whom to operate on first. By choosing one, then necessarily another must die. My father asked me, when people arrived at the railhead, what was I supposed to do? People were arriving infected with disease, half dead. He said it was beyond anyone's imagination to describe the circumstances there. His job had been to classify only those able to work and those unable to work. He said he tried to grade as many people able to work as possible. What my father was trying to do was to persuade me that in this manner he had saved thousands of people from certain death. He said that he did not order and was not responsible for gassings, and he said that twins in the camp owed their lives to him. He said that he, personally, had never harmed anyone in his life. The more that Mengele perverted the truth, the angrier he seemed to become. Sensing Rolf's incredulity, he shouted at him, "Don't tell me you, my only son, believe what they write about me! On my mother's life, I have never hurt anyone." It was at this point that father and son agreed no useful purpose would be served in pursuing the debate. As Rolf explained, "I realized that this man, my father, was just too rigid. Despite all his knowledge and intellect, he just did not want to see the basis and rules for the simplest humanity in Auschwitz. He didn't understand that his presence alone had made him an accessory within the deepest meaning of inhumanity. There was no point in going on. I had to resign myself to that fact. He did promise to write everything down. He kept saying that if I had time to study what he meant, I might see his point. But unfortunately, he never did. "In the end," said Rolf, "it was impossible to discuss the concepts of evil or guilt because his father felt no guilt." I tried. These allegations, these facts, left me speechless. I tried to tell him that his presence in Auschwitz alone was unacceptable to me. I was hoping he'd say, "I tried to get a transfer to the front, I did this, I did that," but it didn't come to this preliminary agreement. Unfortunately, I realized that he would never express any remorse or feeling of guilt in my presence. The confrontation between father and son was not visible to the neighbors and rare visitors. To neighbors, the young man who was seen staying with Pedro was his nephew. "A good-looking young man," recalled Mengele's housemaid, Elsa d'Oliveira. Despite the unbridgeable gap, Rolf found his father mentally alert. He spoke Latin and Greek, and still had a lively and inquiring mind. They walked together and shopped together, buying a ceiling lamp to enliven the drab hallway. Rolf remembers that everyone appreciated him, and everyone liked him. Together, they visited the Bossets, and they travelled to Mengele's earlier homes in Serra Negra and Caieiras. Rolf recalls that owners at both farms were pleased at the visit and proudly presented to us the well-done handwork of Senor Pedro. A visit to the Stammers, however, was more strained. My visit to the Stammers was welcome on the one hand because they were very curious about me. On the other hand, they had a bad conscience, of course, caused by the way they got rid of him in the end. They had a terrible fear that their future daughter-in-law, who was present, would hear the name Mengele, the name under which I introduced myself to them. So I quickly changed to Wilfried Busse again. The Stammers were building a new house. My father told me that the Stammers had an economic advantage over him during all those years. He could do nothing since he was dependent on them. They borrowed money from him and were surprised, even angry, when he wanted to have it back later. They were quite pleased when we left. But while the Stammers gave Rolf a cool reception, the Bossets were completely different, extremely correct. They tried their best to make Rolf's stay a pleasurable one. Yet they sensed there was difficulty between father and son. Lieselotte Bossert remembers the situation. "I didn't think they got on very well, but there was some sort of respect between them. Because Rolf Mengele is part of present-day Germany, and probably has feelings of guilt that he was looking for in his father but didn't find. Because his father didn't feel guilty. He was a scientist and thought to have acted properly, from his point of view, in his earlier days. While the Bossetts analyzed Rolf and his relationship with his father, Rolf was drawing first-hand conclusions about the psychological dependencies and weaknesses that had formed between his father and his protectors, the Stammers and the Bossetts. Rolf could see why his father had fallen out with the former and had become friendly with the latter. He, Mengele, didn't realize how he had troubled the Stammers with his sharp intelligence, his pointed remarks, his logic and his arguing. They must have considered him a senior schoolmaster, and were certainly glad and relieved to finally get rid of him. At last they could live an illogical, disorderly, lazy, pleasure-seeking life again, their way of life, without a bad conscience, and without playing the hypocrite of play-acting for him. As for the Bossetts, he was the connection with the past, a justification for their own past. He intellectually stimulated them, and he explained to them a lot of things so they were able to understand new things. But mainly he was a person who needed their help and their devotion. A man who was also worth their devotion. A man who had been driven out, who was not understood. They helped him completely unselfishly. And, unlike the Stammers, when he got on their nerves, they simply said so to him, or they just went away. Since Rolf favored the Bossetts, he spent considerable time with them during his trip. They took his father to Bertioga, the beach where he was to die 16 months later. At the Bossetts' suggestion, Mengele took Rolf to a small jewelry shop in El Dorado, where he bought a $500 emerald ring for Rolf's fiancée, Almut. As Rolf's visit stretched into the second week, the Bossetts thought the relationship between father and son seemed to be improving. However, Rolf knew the brick wall he had encountered on the subject of the Holocaust would never break down. After only 2 weeks, Rolf decided it was time to go. Their farewell at the Sao Paulo airport was a brief and formal affair. Mengele was too preoccupied with his fear that someone might be watching to openly express any emotion. "We shall try to meet again very soon, all of us," were his last words. But Rolf knew he would never see his father again. After meeting with his friend in Rio for a few days of sightseeing, Rolf flew home to Frankfurt. He re-entered West Germany using his real passport. No questions were asked about the fact that the son of Josef Mengele had just returned from South America, his father's presumed sanctuary. The German customs officials even failed to notice that the passport lacked the required entry visa stamp for Brazil. For Mengele, Rolf's journey home was another anxious time. "I felt enormous tension," he later wrote to him. "I didn't know whether you'd need help, considering the stricter controls at German points of entry. You didn't confirm your arrival back in Germany, so I was pretty nervous by the time your letter finally reached me 4 weeks later." In this letter, Mengele thanked Rolf for the many endearing and unforgettable days they spent together, complaining about the shortness of Rolf's visit. But there had not been much left to say, he conceded, "facing the fact that you are not sensitive to my influence." Notwithstanding the complaints, Rolf recognized that his father had discovered a newfound respect for his son. He was proud of his son, like a soldier after a successful reconnaissance patrol. After all, he was like his son, even if different. Pig-headed and spoiled by the post-war propaganda and by the stepfather's home and education. All that will settle down. At least the son had found the right wife. Soon he would be a grandfather. That visit gave him fresh impetus and new hope. A month later, Mengele wrote to Rolf again, this time to congratulate him and his second wife, Almut, on their wedding. "If I had known how much you enjoyed precious stones, I would have sent you a bigger one," Mengele told his new daughter-in-law. "Now that Rolf had a wife," he said, It might help him get closer to his son. And then he expressed gratitude to Rolf for taking the trouble to see him after all those years apart. Now I can die in peace. Chapter 18. My life is at an end. Rolf Mengele's meeting with his father finally relieved the conflict between his obligations as a lawyer and his blood ties as a son. He would not hand over his father to the authorities. In the end, he was my father, said Rolf. I couldn't report him to the police. But the fear that he might yet be discovered still preyed heavily on Mengele's mind. Even in the final miserable year of his life, he never once lifted his guard. The Bossets suggested that he move to a more cheerful neighborhood, but for Mengele, a change of scenery carried an unacceptable risk. Any widening of the circle of people you get to know inherently brings unpredictable dangers, he said. These have to be compared with the advantages to be expected. More than ever now, he craved friendship and company. He told Rolf he had hopes of getting to know an Austrian couple that had moved nearby, but his highest hopes were pinned on his new housemaid, nearly 40 years his junior, a small, sharp-featured woman with bleached blonde hair. Elsa Gulpian d'Oliveira had gone to work for the old man she knew only as Don Pedro in response to an advertisement. Mengele came to depend heavily on her for company. When she was there, he was happy. When she left, he moped. Elsa grew fond of her boss. He was well-preserved and good-looking, she said. I admired his politeness, things that a woman would admire. While she cleaned his house and cooked his food, Mengele wrote in his diary or went for long walks. He tried to introduce her to classical music and the arts. When her sister married, Mengele took Elsa's hand for a dance. Soon there were expensive gifts, a gold bracelet, a ring, a white woolen shawl. Although he never once tried to kiss her, Elsa became the sole object of his emotional desire. For the third time in his life, Josef Mengele had fallen in love. Elsa recalls his possessiveness. He never liked my having boyfriends. He always used to say, "This one isn't going to work out," or "That one doesn't really care about you." He started to ask me why I made myself look good to go out with young men, but not when I went out with him. One day, he invited one of my boyfriends to the house, and as we came down the stairs holding hands, he stared at us. Later, he told me he was jealous of me holding hands with the young man, and he confessed that he loved me and asked me to move in with him. Elsa refused. I told him that I would not live with him unless he married me, she said. I told him I wanted to get married legally. If he had asked me, I would have married him. But Mengele was distraught. He started crying and said he couldn't marry me, but he wouldn't tell me why, she said. Spurned so late in life, Mengele behaved like a lovesick boy. He pestered Elsa's mother, promising he would give her daughter a good and homely life. He broke down in front of her and sobbed. My mother and I used to get very nervous, said Elsa. My mother would say, "How crazy is that man?" He even walked back and forth in front of our house, waiting for me. Elsa had brought a new light into Mengele's life, but in October 1978, she went out of it as quickly as she had come in when she announced that she intended to get married. Mengele never quite recovered from the shock. He cried and said I must not marry my husband because he really didn't care for me, she said. He cried and said he was going to die soon. From then on, Mengele declined rapidly. I had a bad time of it these past 2 months, he wrote to Sedlmeier. Barbaric pains, sleepless nights, and disappointments. Once more, thoughts of suicide entered his head. Long-lasting pain of this kind causes one to be very nervous and sick of living. Mengele was now plagued by high blood pressure, a severe inner ear infection, and a prostate condition. His degenerating spine was also very painful. Even his few friends had tired of his moaning. He complained that Wolfram Bossert had told him it was a good thing that I lived alone because of all my moaning and sighing. I really wouldn't wish my pain on this insensitive man. And he accused his family of virtually abandoning him. No one told me about the birth of Rolf's baby, he wrote to Stedelmeyer. He was especially grieved by the silence from Rolf. Amid the wretchedness of these last months came a sinister echo from his past. Rolf's wife, Almut, had aroused Mengele's interest because she was a twin. The nosiness of this old explorer of family heredity should be understandable, he wrote. For the first time, one of us has chosen his partner from the north, he said. These incoming Nordic genes are to be appreciated, and the best results are to be expected from this combination. Mengele asked Almut for more details of her family background, but he did not get a reply. Life in Alvarenga Road now seemed empty and devoid of purpose. Mengele tried to fill the gaping hole left in his life by Elsa's departure. Ines Mielich, a maid who had worked part-time for him before, agreed to live in, sleeping in a makeshift wooden hut in his back garden. Sometimes, she said, Mengele behaved like a small child. He was so anxious that he once pounded on the door of my hut in the middle of the night, she said. I opened it and he said, Oh, I'm sorry, I just wanted to make sure you were there. Okay, it's all right. Good night. By Christmas 1978, Mengele had lost the will to live. He walked around in an absent-minded daze, not seeming to care what might happen to him. Once he nearly fell down a well in the backyard. Another time he was almost killed when he ventured outside. Neighbors, startled by the screech of brakes, saw a bus straddling the road amid the swirling dust. Mengele grazed yet shuffling out of sight, as if oblivious of his brush with death. It was in this distracted frame of mind that Mengele left his bungalow at 5555 Alvarenga Road for the last time. He seemed to know that he might never return. After agonizing for several days, he finally accepted an invitation from the Bossets to stay at their rented beach house at Bertioga, 25 miles south of Sao Paulo. It was late January 1979, the height of a sweltering Brazilian summer. He kept wondering whether it would do his spirits any good, Ines recalled. He said he was very tired, but in the end agreed to take the trip. I am going to the beach because my life is at an end, he told me. Alone, he took the 2-hour bus ride to Bertioga, arriving there on February 5th. Lieselotte Bossert remembers. He started letting off steam right away. He seemed to be very irritated by something. For most of the next 2 days, Mengele stayed inside the tiny 2-bedroom beach house. Its shutters were closed despite the broiling heat. It must have been like a steam bath inside, said Arnaldo Santana, who lived behind the summer house. I was working close by, and I could hear talking, always in German. At 3 p.m. on February 7th, Mengele finally emerged. We thought a walk would soothe his mind, as he would see nature, the beach, and the water, said Lieselotte. It was another hot day, the sunshine blazing down. He and Wolfram Bossert walked along the beach, and then sat in the sun for a while. Bossert recalled that Mengele was heartsick for Germany. I am convinced that he was longing to return to Germany. That was clear toward the end. On the last day, he made it clear. I don't know whether he knew death was coming, but he was sitting on a large rock by the sea, all by himself, looking out across the sea to the east. And he said, Over there is my country. I would like to spend the last days of my life in my native town of Günzburg, somewhere at the top of a mountain, in a little house, and to write the history of my native town. That was what he really wanted. At the time, I didn't think anything of it, but knowing now what happened that day, I can remember it quite clearly. About 4:30 in the afternoon, to cool off from the burning sun, Mengele decided to chance the gentle Atlantic waves. 10 minutes later, he was fighting for his life. Young Andreas Bossert saw him first and shouted, "Uncle, come out! The current is too strong!" Alerted by his son, Wolfram Bossert looked up and saw a thrashing movement in the sea. He called out and asked Mengele if he was all right. A grimace of pain was the only response. Plunging into the sea, Bossert swam as fast as he could to rescue his friend. By the time he reached him, there was scarcely any movement left. Paralysis had seized his body. Young Andreas Bossert remembers a lifeless body lying lopsided on the water, bobbing up and down with the swell of the sea. Mengele had had a second stroke. Bossert recalls the frantic few moments. "I had to swim with one arm and drag him with the other, and the sea was dragging us both out. I fought and fought, trying to keep his head above water, never feeling any ground under my feet, so that I knew that we weren't getting any closer to shore. I got to a stage where I felt I couldn't hold on any longer. But then, somewhere in my subconscious, I had a thought that I should use the force of the waves. So I dived in, digging my heels into the sand, and then holding the body above my head. He was still alive then." Suddenly and unexpectedly, Mengele began to make a desperate last fight for life. His eyes now fixed earnestly ahead, he was trying to swim with one arm, his strokes getting stronger. For a moment, it seemed that he had survived the worst. But then his face lost all its determination, his arm fell back, and there was no movement. Bossert remembers his effort to just carry Mengele to shore. "I was left with this dead weight. I surfaced and let myself be carried forward by the waves. Then I dived again, dug my heels into the ground and held him above me, before coming up again. And this is how we managed to get ashore." As Wolfram Bossert got nearer to dry land, a group of rescuers waded out to meet him and grabbed Mengele by his legs and arms, carrying him to the beach. Bossert was quite exhausted from his rescue attempt. So hard had he struggled that he nearly drowned and he had to go to the hospital himself. A clutch of people had gathered as news of the drama spread, Mengele's now motionless body lying on the sand. A doctor who had seen it all massaged his heart and administered the kiss of life. For a few moments there was a flicker of response, but in the end the doctor's efforts were to no avail. The body was left on the beach until late that night. Every few minutes it had to be dragged farther up the sand because of the incoming tide. "I nearly had a screaming fit," said Lieselotte Bossert. "It was so undignified." Then a policeman, Expeditio Gius Romau, came to take charge of the body. Accidents were not uncommon on this popular stretch of sand, but Romau said he would always remember this one. Darkness had fallen by the time he arrived. Kneeling in an almost reverential pose was Lieselotte Bossert, holding a candle at the dead man's head and wailing, "The uncle is dead! The uncle is dead!" Chapter 19. Keep Everything a Secret. Rolf Mengele's first reaction to the news of his father's death was one of enormous relief. "I basically had a conflict that could never be resolved," he said. "On the one hand, he was my father. On the other hand, there were these allegations, these horrific pictures of Auschwitz. I was very relieved that this situation came about, and not another, like maybe a trial, as important as it might have been." Word of the uncle's demise reached the Mengele family by letter from Wolfram Bossert to Sedlmeier. "It is with deep sorrow that I fulfill the painful duty of informing you and the relatives of the death of our common friend. Right up to his last breath of air, he fought heroically, just as he had done during his life full of turmoil." The funeral had been a rushed and traumatic affair. It was all over within 24 hours. Immediate disposal of the body was urgently required in that subtropical heat, yet formalities had to be completed. Lieselotte Bossert had to cope with them alone, because her husband was recovering in the hospital from his rescue attempt. He was so exhausted that the doctor told her she was lucky not to have lost him, too. Shortly before his death, Mengele had told the Bossets he wished to be cremated. Given the time and regulations, that had not been possible to arrange. In this mainly Catholic country, there are still strict rules to follow concerning this, Bossert explained to Sedlmeier. The Brazilian authorities required a signature from a close relative, guaranteeing that all the surviving members of the deceased's family agreed to cremation. Anticipating this problem, and unknown to Mengele, Wolfgang Gerhard had made provision for a burial plot next to his own mother's at Our Lady of the Rosary Cemetery on a hillside at Embu, 12 miles west of Sao Paulo. On his brief visit in 1976, Gerhard had even taken the trouble to prepare the cemetery director, Gino Carita, for the arrival of a sickly older relative. But when Gerhard's plan was put into action, it almost backfired. The corpse had been put in a coffin at a first aid station and taken straight to the local coroner, Dr. Jaime Edson Andrade Mendonça, who just prodded the body. At 2 a.m., he was in no mood for a complete post-mortem. Lieselotte Bossert heard the man who had brought in the coffin say, "Well, it's obvious, the person has drowned." Mendonça then issued a death certificate in the name of Wolfgang Gerhard, aged 53. Confronted with a simple white coffin and a certificate showing the death of the man who had actually booked the burial plot, Gino Carita was very curious. Carita said he wanted to open the coffin and see the body. Lieselotte Bossert recalls the event. "When he saw the name Wolfgang Gerhard, quite a rare name in these parts, he immediately remembered him and said, 'It can't be possible. He mentioned an old uncle, and now he is here himself. He said to me that we should, perhaps, look at him now.' And then I knew straight away that this was the last thing I had to do, that nobody should discover that it was the body of Mengele. Nobody must ever know this. And that's why I became hysterical and said, 'No, I don't want to, I can't. My husband is ill, and I don't know how he is, and I am all alone here, and I want to get the whole thing over with as quickly as possible.' The man said he respected my wishes, especially as a body pulled out of the water is never a pretty sight. So he went along with my wishes." Carita relented, not wishing to offend a grieving friend of the deceased, and Mengele's secret was taken to the grave. The irony is that had Mengele's wish for cremation been carried out, his life in Brazil would probably have remained a secret forever. It was the exhumation of his bones 6 years later that provided scientific proof of his identity. Anything less would undoubtedly not have satisfied his hunters, raised on a diet of press fantasies about his superhuman powers of escape. Certainly, it had never been the intention of the Bossets and the Mengele family to divulge the truth. On the face of it, the Mengele family's decision not to announce Josef's death seems a surprising one. In strictly commercial terms, an announcement of Mengele's death could only have benefited the family firm in Günzburg, vulnerable as it was to accusations of complicity in his continuing freedom. At least that is what everyone assumed. "There is no reason for the family not to announce his death," commented a skeptical police superintendent, Menachem Rusek, head of the Nazi crimes section of Israel's police, when news first broke of Mengele's hillside grave. "It's a trick. He's still alive." In fact, the family had calculated that the financial benefits from an announcement were far outweighed by the torrent of questions that this would raise about their 40 years of collaboration. As they had done in the past, the Mengele family had placed their own financial interests as the top priority. ignoring any moral obligation to Mengele's hunters or survivors to announce the death and end the case. They, the Mengele family, replied in a letter that naturally the case was much too dangerous to be revealed, and that much water would have to flow under the bridge before this could be expected, said Wolfram Bosset. Moreover, the final decision rested with Mengele's next of kin, his son, Rolf. And Rolf decided, out of consideration to those who had helped my father, that the world should be left to go on guessing, at least for a while. Non-disclosure was certainly what the Bossets desired, though for even more perverse reasons. Not only does it avoid personal inconvenience, but it also keeps the opposing side wasting money on something that is antiquated, Wolfram Bosset wrote to Sedlmeier. Since Wolfgang Gerhardt had died of a cerebral hemorrhage 2 months before Mengele, Bosset suggested that Gerhardt's children be paid a settlement allowance, because the Gunzbergers would need their collaboration for the paperwork if they decided to transport Mengele's body back to Germany for a proper funeral. The Mengeles preferred to leave matters as they were. For the second time in 2 years, Rolf flew to Sao Paulo, this time to collect his father's effects and settle his affairs. He flew under his own name and passport, leaving Frankfurt on a regularly scheduled airliner. He spent Christmas with the Bossets, not returning to West Germany until January 3, 1980. The Bossets were rewarded handsomely for sheltering his father. Rolf gave them the $1,000 cash left over from the $5,000 he had brought his father during the 1977 trip. Rolf also gave the house at 5555 Alvarenga Road to be equally divided between the Bossets and the Stammers. It may have been run down, but it was worth $25,000. The Stammers eventually sold their share to the Bossets, who took over the entire property. The Bossets were grateful to Rolf for his generosity and thanked him in a subsequent letter for allowing us to achieve a lifelong dream. Rolf took his father's gold watch, letters, diaries, and pictures. Emotionally, I believe, as you probably would, it is best to burn all of it, Bosset had written to Sedlmeier. On the other hand, his fate is too remarkable. The descendants do deserve an intellectual heritage, even if the current generation doesn't consider it important. These lofty ideals faded 6 years later when Mengele's corpse was discovered at Embu. Representatives of Stern magazine beat a path to the Bossets' door and paid them a handsome fee for some unimportant remnants of Mengele's papers and photographs they had hidden from Rolf on his 1979 trip. After gathering his father's personal material, Rolf proceeded to Rio and checked into the posh Otton Palace Hotel, where he had stayed 2 years earlier under a false name. That caused one of the most awkward moments in his life. "Ah, Mengele," said the concierge. "Do you know you have a very famous name around here?" Rolf feigned a jolly laugh. Inside, he was shaking like jelly. He hid the duffel bag in the dropped ceiling of his hotel room. "Any professional search would have found the material in less than a minute," said Rolf, "but it was the best I could do." Why did it take 6 years for the secret of Mengele's Brazilian exile and his death to emerge? Aside from a small circle of unrepentant Nazis like Hans Rudel, there were by now almost 40 close friends and family who knew, but never said a word. Among these were Rolf, his first wife, Irmi, and her parents, his second wife, Almut, and her parents, the Jenkels, Mengele's first wife, Irena, her husband, Alfons Hakenjoos, their son, Jens, and his wife, Zabina, who was Rolf's secretary, Mengele's nephews, Dieter and Karl Heinz, and their wives, his nieces, Uta and Monika, and their husbands, Mengele's second wife, Marta, and her son, Wolf Ensmann, from her first marriage, Rolf and Almut's friend, Wilfried Busser, the pharmacist and his wife in Munich, Mengele's friends, who had provided him safe shelter in 1945, the Stammers and their two children, the Bossets and their two children, the Glavers and their son, and, of course, the dissembling Hans Stedelmeier, his wife and their two children, one a doctor and the other a lawyer. It is extraordinary that such loyalty to a man so patently evil and to his family overrode any consideration of higher morality or public duty. Stranger still, that from somewhere in the supposedly enlightened ranks of the younger Mengeles, not a word was leaked to the authorities, even after his death. The truth had to be wrested from this arcane and amoral brotherhood, which was divided by bitter jealousies over money and power, but united in the common goal of saving their necks, and the neck of one of the nastiest men ever known to have inhabited the earth. In the end, it was public pressure that forced the authorities to go on the offensive and flush out the facts. That process began in late 1977, with the very people who had helped create the myth of Mengele's invincibility and his high-level protection in Paraguay, the Nazi hunters and amateur sleuths. The idea of Paraguay as Mengele's permanent home had long been ingrained in the public consciousness. It was the frustrating lack of progress in confirming this established fact that persuaded the United States and Israel to resolve the Mengele mystery once and for all. In August 1977, a dubious story in a glossy Argentine magazine reported that Josef Mengele had been seen driving a black sedan through the streets of Asunción. Simon Wiesenthal went a step further. In September, he told Time magazine that Mengele had two posh houses and was always surrounded by armed bodyguards with walkie-talkies. Mengele wore dark glasses, he said, and was an active member of a surviving network of Nazi bigwigs known as Die Spinne, the Spider. According to Wiesenthal, Mengele was a frequent visitor to the German club in Asunción, where he often made a spectacle of himself by slamming his pistol on the bar. Time also reported the claims of a recent visitor to Paraguay, Professor Richard Ahrens of the Law Faculty at Temple University in Philadelphia. Ahrens claimed that Paraguayan defense officials had told him that Mengele was in the country as President Stroessner's close advisor on torture techniques and that he had been experimenting on defenseless Aché Indians in the Chaco. Despite the best efforts of the American embassy in Asunción to persuade Time that the story was probably fictitious, the magazine went ahead and published it. Inaccurate as it was, the Time article lit a slow-burning fuse on the Mengele hunt, which had been curiously absent from the front pages for 3 years. Those first wisps of smoke appeared with an inquiry to the State Department from Senator Alan Cranston, Jr., in January 1978. The Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations, Douglas J. Bennett, Jr., replied that although the State Department could not confirm that Mengele was in Paraguay, it was difficult for the United States government to become directly involved in the Mengele case, because Mengele does not reside in the United States, and the crimes of which he is accused did not occur in United States territory. Just to be certain, the department cabled the U.S. Embassy in Asunción, requesting any hard information on Mengele's presence, past or now, in Paraguay, and his activities, or at least detailed comments on the Mengele reference in the Time article. The following day, the embassy cabled back Paraguayan Interior Minister Sabino Montanaro's response. He said that Mengele took out citizenship in 1959, lived in Paraguay for about 2 years, or until 1961 to 1962. Mengele has not re-entered Paraguay since that time. If you do not believe me, I will be glad to show you the police record. The trouble was that no one any longer believed a word the Paraguayans said. Their public denials during the 1960s of Mengele's Paraguayan citizenship and their refusal to actively assist in the hunt, coupled with their appalling record on human rights, had irreparably damaged their credibility. The State Department, however, had detected a shift in the Paraguayan government's attitude since President Jimmy Carter came to power in 1976. Now Paraguay was wrestling with an image problem caused by the Carter administration's highlighting of its record of torture and detention without trial. With Time magazine having resurrected the specter of Asunción as a haven for the world's most wanted man, the government faced a major public relations crisis. Paraguay was certainly a refuge for many wanted men, but even Montanaro bridled at what seemed to be a rerun of all the old allegations that Mengele and Stroessner were close friends. The subject of Mengele soon became a regular topic of conversation for Ambassador Robert White when he took the Paraguayans to task over their repressive regime. "When I got to Asunción, the Paraguayan government would say to me, 'What can we do to improve our image abroad?' I would reply that one of the things they could do was cancel Mengele's citizenship. We discussed it quite a bit." In March 1979, the CBS 60 Minutes program screened a shortened version of a British documentary on the hunt for Mengele. With the assistance of a resourceful German doctor, John Ware and Mike Beckham of Granada Television had obtained secretly filmed conversations with several of Mengele's former Paraguayan friends, including Alban Krug, Armando Reynarts, a hotelier who had met him, and Werner Schubius, who knew him in Asunción. For the first time, there was on the record evidence that Mengele had been sheltered, at least for a time, in Paraguay after the Eichmann kidnapping. In the documentary, Krug evaded questions as to when exactly he had sheltered Mengele, and muttered threats about not advising anyone to come looking for him here. Granada had also obtained, for the first time, a copy of Mengele's Paraguayan citizenship document. When Israel's former ambassador in Asunción, Benjamin Varon, appeared in the film, saying Mengele had one of his homes in Paraguay at least until 1972, the overall effect of the program was to indicate that the government of Paraguay still had something to hide. Seen by 20 million viewers, the program made a significant impact. Americans were outraged. Congress was petitioned with letters and telephone calls demanding that America take action to force Paraguay's hand. Responding to the public outcry in June 1979, Senator Jesse Helms submitted Senate Resolution No. 184. "It is the sense of the Senate that the President of the United States should immediately call upon Paraguay to apprehend and extradite Josef Mengele to stand trial in the Federal Republic of Germany." In the debate that followed, Senator Helms referred to Mengele's work in genetic engineering as the Frankenstein Project of the Century. Helms expressed a view that seemed to shake the United States out of its post-war apathy. "The fact that Josef Mengele should remain today in freedom, never having been brought to trial, makes him a living symbol of the Holocaust we cannot continue to tolerate. To forgive or forget the crimes of Josef Mengele would require the amputation of our conscience and the dismemberment of our memory." The Senate unanimously passed the resolution urging the president to demand that Paraguay act to arrest and extradite Mengele. In the House of Representatives, 57 congressmen signed a petition that was delivered to the Paraguayan ambassador to Washington, Mario Lopez Escobar, demanding the same action. Paraguayan government-inspired demonstrations against President Carter's tough new approach on human rights had already strained relations between Asunción and Washington. But there was never any doubt about who held the whip. Aid was held back, and defense cuts were threatened. Now, Ambassador White pressed home the congressional demands about Mengele. "Eventually, the Paraguayans responded to my suggestion that his citizenship be revoked. They said, 'What a great idea!'" On August 5th, 1979, Interior Minister Montanaro held a press conference and laid the groundwork for the revocation of Mengele's citizenship. He denied that Mengele was in the country and said truthfully that he had left Paraguay a long time ago. On August 8th, Montanaro directed the Paraguayan Attorney General, Clotildo Jimenez Benitez, to ask the Supreme Court to revoke the citizenship, which it did that same day. The court stated that it had reached its decision because Mengele had been absent from the country since 1960. When Mengele's citizenship was revoked, Ambassador White assumed Mengele must have died. I must say that up until that time, I always believed that actually he was in Paraguay, he said. The ambassador was right, of course, about Mengele's death, though he did not know what had happened in Brazil. The question is, did President Stroessner know? According to Ambassador White, it is inconceivable that Montanaro would have revoked Mengele's citizenship without the president's authority, since he views the status of Paraguayan nationality as sacrosanct. Stroessner must have been consulted, said Ambassador White. If he is right, it suggests that Stroessner was privy to Mengele's death in Brazil within 6 months of its occurrence, but nonetheless allowed the world to go on guessing for another 6 years. No doubt that this is the kind of game that Stroessner